right. Will, Will, where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
So I'm actually from Chicago, like you. I was born there. I lived there for a little while as a childhood. And most of my childhood after that was in Arizona. Yeah. So I never got the accent.
You never got the Chicago accent. That's right. Tell me about your family growing up.
So my family growing up, they're great. It's a mixture of Irish rebels and Italian romantics. So the reason I'm in America, both my parents were first generation born in the United States. So my father's family, they came from Ireland. The reason they came from Ireland primarily was prior to the existence of the IRA, there was something called the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood. And my great-grandfather maybe was known to have potentially sabotaged a British dam in Ireland. So he had to leave, sponsored his family to come over. And my father was the first one born in America. And then on my mother's side, in the wake of the Second World War, Italy was basically a third world country. So if you were Italian, you had three options for the New World if you wanted to move. So it was United States, Venezuela, or Argentina. My grandfather chose Venezuela, the second wealthiest country in the New World. And he worked for the Italian embassy there. I grew up with stories of him talking about Venezuela and the beauty of it and all that, South America. And ultimately, there was a coup, I think, in 58. So he had to leave. He went and said, yeah, United States isn't so bad. So I'll go there. And so that's how my family ended up in the United States. They all ended up in Chicago. Parents met, had a wonderful love story. And then they ended up migrating to Arizona. I'm here, or I was in Arizona, because of books. My grandfather, the Irish one, the Irish have this kind of fixation with the West, the cowboy culture, et cetera. I remember when I visited Ireland the first time, I was asked by a cousin, do the Indians still have teepees? How do they live? What religion are they? And it's like, no, they have houses. But my grandfather had Zane Grey novels all throughout his house. So my dad grew up with stories of the West, and then he fell in love with it when he was in Fort Huachuca. So he did army training there. So ultimately, decades later, they decided to stay in Arizona. In my childhood, I was an only child, so it was great. I mean, I had two loving parents. They were incredibly supportive, and yeah, they raised me in much more of like a European kind of way. So I remember the first time I was ever baffled hearing someone just identify as white, because I didn't, you know, being from Chicago, there's more ethnic neighborhoods, Italians and Irish and Poles, etc. And I remember a kid telling me, I'm just white, and I went, what the fuck does that mean? How do you not know where your grandparents are from or wherever in Europe they're from? And I never seen that. So I knew culturally there was a big difference living in Arizona and growing up in Arizona than somewhere like Chicago. But yeah, they were fantastic parents. I still have my mom. I don't have my dad. He passed away 3.5 years ago. But it was an idyllic childhood.
It's great to have great parents.
It is, yeah.
Probably the most important break a person can get.
I really feel like I won the lottery in life. I think everyone wins a lottery at some point. Some people win the actual lottery. Some people it's meeting the right person. For me, one of the lotteries I won was my parents, for sure.
Having good parents is the best of those three by a long shot.
I would say I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah. So, tell me about your childhood, school years, all that.
So school years, there was always something a little different with me. I was always curious about the outside world. I got in fights a lot. I had those cool parents that told me, hey, if you're ever bullied, defend yourself. You know, knock the other kid down. We'll come out and help you. I've come to a theory, you know, this is germane to the conversation, that I think that when you think about it from a psychic or psychological perspective, it is a matrix, the school system. You know, I started and my parents came out here. One of the benefits was for that. We moved neighborhoods because the school system was much better when I was younger. But it didn't matter. The school system is a matrix, right? And I'm fervently a believer that the bullies that exist in schools work for the school. They don't know that they work for the school, but they do work for the school. And the administrators don't know that the bullies work for the school, but they acknowledge and they do work for the school. What I mean by that is, we've all had the anecdotal experience of being bullied or seeing someone bullied, and the administrators kind of give someone a wide space, the school bully, the troubled kid. And as soon as the first kid rises up violently and defends themselves, we've all seen it, the school administration throws the book at that kid. Usually that kid's the one that gets punished more severely. That kid gets thrown into the mix with the bully. And I think it's this weird conditioning subconsciously that we're acting on, that we're conditioning people to kind of not do that, not question authority, right? That's the experience I've had. That's the experience I've seen when that has happened. So I got in fights as a kid, and I had all these, but not a lot. It was just, it was, you know, here and there. But I knew I was different. I had those experiences, and by first, second grade, we moved school districts, not for the fighting, just because we moved. And it was okay. I mean, third and fourth grade were fine. But there was always that sense of being an outsider. It wasn't until maybe fifth or sixth grade that things started to change more. I started having teachers recommend me for like talented youth programs. These were programs that were usually hosted by a local university where you'd go for the summer and you would be given advanced schooling. So you'd go and you'd get like an eighth grade or 10th grade level of instruction in something like math or science or things like that. And I remember, having those experiences. I remember my mom said that I cried when I left the university because I really loved that experience, being around all that learning, et cetera. I remember it was the first time I ever experienced being a minority in a classroom setting because everyone was Asian. Yeah, I remember going back saying, why are they all Chinese? And my mom had to explain, well, you know, their culture, they were really into education and that's what they're into. I go, oh, okay, interesting. But by sixth grade especially, I'm about 11, and that's the age when kids are kind of getting into their pre-adolescent bodies and they're getting better motor skills, more fine-tuned motor skills, but they're acting erratic, crazy. I think, the Ritalin generation I was around, you know? It was, my parents never medicated me, but I was around the kids that were medicated. And they were just, they were acting with these weird antisocial behaviors, the type of stuff you'd go to a school and they'd say like, oh, I'm gonna kill you today. And like, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? Do I attack you now or do I wait to be attacked? Like, what is this? And my parents, again, coolest people, and they raised me with this very unique, let's navigate the world the way we need to. So I remember when I was like 9, this is going back a little bit, but around Columbine times, right? 1999, I think that was. So in 1999, 2000, my parents sat me down and said, all right, you're in school, you're in public school still. You find the weirdest kid in school. You find the most antisocial kid there is. You be friends with that kid. Because if that kid cracks and decides to shoot up the school, he'll warn his friends. So, you know, they were very street smart being from Chicago. But as time went on, I realized this was getting worse and worse just with the behavior. So they were kind enough to give me an out. So around sixth grade, age 11, my mom sat me down, I remember, with the clipboard and ruled paper. And it was kind of like the scene from Office Space where the auditors come in. They're like, what exactly do you do all day? And she wanted to know, well, what is it that you actually do on a daily basis? I said, well, you know, we have our Pledge of Allegiance, and then we have, first period, we have recess, and then we have this and that, and we have an hour break, and et cetera, et cetera. And my mom, by the time tabulated, it's about 2.5 hours of instructed learning that took place out of a 6-hour day. So they offered me the chance to be homeschooled from there. And they gave me the out. And I said, God, yes, get me out of here. I'll take it. And that began kind of the unconventional education. Wow.
So you left public school?
Yes, I left public school at sixth grade, so age 11. And I was only homeschooled for about a year and a half. So it was a different kind of background. My mom got the curriculum ready. Homeschooling was a little bit different back then, but it was just kind of gaining traction with people that were waking up to the fact that there really wasn't a ton of learning happening in the public school system whatsoever. What it was the schools themselves are, I believe, dictated by the lowest common denominator. And I was in fifth grade when they passed No Child Left Behind, which I think was a big mistake, because I remember there were kids that were holding back the entire class, and we kind of had to just go with that kid, the slow kid. And nothing wrong with them, it's just maybe they're a little slower. So my mom put two and two together, got the curriculum ready, and she got this amount of textbooks and gave it to me and said, okay, this will be your thing every day. I want you to just study these tell me what you did at the end of the day, check it off, and we'll go from there. And within a very short period of time, I was able to accomplish like the middle school and high school curriculum that was required by the state of Arizona. We realized that it was a very quick pace. I didn't have a summer break. It wasn't like I was one of the more like an Asian kid, like you study and sit in my room for 10 hours a day. It was maybe like 3 or 4 hours a day, just kind of going through these different things, writing reports, and then handed my mom and she'd say, okay, that works.
It was easy for you.
It was easy. I'm kind of a self-starter. I'm a type B personality, but when I'm interested in something or I have a certain challenge in front of me, I'm more motivated. So it was the fact of, can I do this? Can I at least try and keep going? And that's when I got the gumption of, and a lot of people always asked or said later on when they'd meet me, oh, you're so well socialized. You were homeschooled? It's like, yeah, I mean, I interacted with people. I actually had there was a homeschool group at the time that I was part of. Those kids were weird. Those kids, I was fine. But those kids were a little unusual. But you'd go and you meet them and you'd have your social time with them and be out and about. But yeah, it was easier for me. And I remember I did these tests and I realized maybe I should take the SAT. And I approached my parents and said, SAT, can I, or ACT, whatever it was. And they said, are you ready? I go, yeah, I'll take a quick prep course and see what we can do. So at age 12, I sat for the SATs or ACTs of my state. And I scored okay enough that it was admissible that I could potentially apply for colleges. And
what age?
12. I was 12. So I turned 13 and I was granted admission into Mesa Community College. It was like a local college. And the system's not built for this at all. It's not built for people with unconventional backgrounds. It was kind of fascinating when I look back about the random challenges that you wouldn't think would be there for someone of that age. So one of them was the absolute disbelief when I went in for the administration, and they were like, well, one guy I remember sat dead face across from me and my parents, and he said, this, to let him in would be an insult to the institution. And I remember I'm on the verge of tears because I'm like, he called me an insult. And my mom, she said, we're going to talk to it. It was very fun. She's like, we're going to go back and talk to someone else. And so I kind of got in this kind of power struggle between these two administrators because she knew, both my parents have a very good people energy sensing skills. They knew that there was one of the other administrators didn't like this one that we were talking to. So we just went to that guy. And that guy said, oh, yeah, I'm going to help you out, kid. And I took some tests and they said, as long as you can pass the entrance exams to come here. Because what was throwing them was the fact that I didn't have the signed off diploma from a high school. Arizona State only required you to have who your primary educator was give you a signature of, hey, this person has finished their education. Thus, they have finished high school and they're ready to move forward. And not too many administrators of colleges, public or private, had the case of homeschooled people approaching them for continued education. So I took the entrance exam, scored pretty high, and was able to get a scholarship to go to the local college for a while. And I started there part-time when I was 13, kept going part-time, and then graduated there when I was 15 years old. Yeah. It was helpful to have a scholarship because I could not work. And the ironic aspect of getting funding is most scholarships that you apply for privately, at least at that time, circa 2004, 2005, required you to be 18 years old to apply. So there was very unique circumstances around that. So I transferred from there. I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
No. Oh, okay. I want to hear all the details. This is fascinating.
So at 16.
And you're like a straight A student through all
these? No. So that's the thing. That humbles you real quick when you realize there was the social aspect here too, because dating would be difficult, right? It wouldn't be.
Is there any dating?
Well, I mean, it's like I'm a 13-year-old boy. Then
you're like older women.
Well, it did inform my tastes, and so like I liked the older. You know, it was nice. There's these elegant, mature, well-dressed. Keep in mind, it's a totally different generation. It's a totally different era. I'm going to school with the equivalent of Gen X. A lot of them, like late Gen X or earliest of possible.
So you're like 15, and the girls are.
Oh, yeah. So I'm like, please, ladies, someone molest me.
Girl, you know, the women are 20.
They're not into it. They're not. I'm like, it's not statutory if I smile. No, they're not. I was fighting an uphill battle, really, being charming, trying to be charming. And I was much more awkward than I am now. But I felt, you know, drawn to the fact that they were around me. And here's the ironic part. If I wanted that situation of the power differential, like being the younger guy with the old, I could have just stayed in high school and gotten with one of those like emotionally unstable 24 or 25 year old women that become teachers and get involved in an affair with their student. But no, I had to prove a point. So that's the irony of it. But yeah, I was around people. But here's the difference. Everybody who was in college at that time, especially in community college, you're seeing a lot of people going back to college in their 30s and in their mid-20s. They wanted to be there, right? So there was none of the resentfulness. There was no bullying. There was none of that. They were wanting to be there. So I kind of had this revolving door of friends, treasured acquaintances, that changed on a regular basis. I never had the high school experience. So that was my frame of reference for high school was everything like all the John Hughes films, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, all that. Never really set foot in high school. But I've heard it's not as all as chalked up to be. So I don't know. But
would you recommend this light, this kind of schooling for a child?
Yes. 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 And in a way, I can address that in a second, just because it's like, I went in a different time. I would recommend it. It's a different kind of experience. I know there are probably programs out there that are more obviously nuanced and hybrid and all that. And my case was an exception. It was more of an outlier as opposed to the norm. But I would say the system's not built for it. I think the issue is, I think I'm intelligent, right? But I can't. Am I the smartest guy ever? No, I'm not even necessarily. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm even necessarily the smartest guy in this room. And it's just me and you, right? It's not really about that. It's more about the capacity a child has. My parents gave me a capacity. They took the seed and they put it in the loamy soil, and they let me grow. And I think the key thing to know is, kids 100 years ago, they were learning Greek. They had Latin. They had algebra by the eighth grade. Our education system's kind of gone. And in general, education has just gone like this. There's an article recently about how kids are having a hard time in college reading the first page of Charles Dickens' Bleak House, which is a book from him. As the first page, they can't give you a summarized concept of what that first page was. That's kind of alarming when you lose reading comprehension skills. So it's all about kind of shaving you down. And a lot of this stems from Rockefeller. In 1902, the Rockefeller formed the General Education Board, which was meant to really influence a vocational style of teaching based off of like what they call the Prussian model. So he was famous for saying, I want a nation of workers, not thinkers. And that's what the school system gives you. So in my case, being exceptional in that regard, I think other people could be exceptional. You just have to give them the ability to explore that capacity. But to answer your other question, was I a straight A student? No. I mean, I was good. I'm mostly A's, but nothing humbles you first like your first C in a class, right? I remember when I first walked into class, again at 13, I was getting a lot of looks from people. And there is that, oh, you must be a child genius and all that. And they'd say, of course, this is older reference, Doogie Howser was used a lot, Neil Patrick Harris's character. And I was thinking, oh, that's a cool card to play, maybe that. And then you get your first C and you're thinking, I got to rein in the child genius card a little bit. Like maybe that's not what we're going for. And, of course, I'm also not an athlete, which is another prized thing in the college life, to be an athlete, not that. So I'm thinking, well, okay, I got to learn some jokes. I'm going to get more people skills. But, no, I was challenged appropriately at the level I was at. That's the way I put it. And I transferred in to ASU when I was 16. So started there, and the economy collapsed. So that was about 2007, and then 2008 came. And I lost a lot of funding for scholarships and all that. So that was a unique experience dealing with trying to scramble to I mean, there was no set education, set graduation date for me necessarily, but it put me back a bit because the scholarships were no longer on the table. And I eventually, at the end of my education, did have to take out a loan. It's like $12,000, but still, at the end, I still had to take on a little debt to push through and to graduation.
Yeah. And did you have a major?
Yes, I majored in microbiology. So that was my major. My intention was to be a doctor. That was my first thought of going to medical school. I decided not to be a doctor, a decision which has saved thousands of lives at this point. Here's the thing. I chose that at a time. You choose that when you're – well, I knew that probably around 13, 14, that's what the major I would want to be, and because it had all the pre-med classes in it. But you're not the same person in your early 20s that you are at 13 years old, no. Right? I remember there was an existential moment. I was in my last – I was a senior for a while, about night 19, finishing it up. And there was a class I used to take called bacterial physiology. And there was a class before that. I didn't know yet what it was, but we were sitting in the hallway. And I just – at the end of this class, I would just hear – claps. All the kids loved this course. I was thinking to myself, at this point, I'm at my low, realizing this is not what I want to do with my life, and lying to myself that I was still going to go to medical school. And I'd hear these kids clapping, and I go, I wish I loved anything as much as these kids love this class. So, and I'd go in there, and I'd see different facts and figures written on the board. It would have international shipping and shorts and stocks, etc. And I remember... eventually, I got the gumption to ask the professor. His name was Barry Siegel. He was an older Jewish guy from New York, in case the name didn't give it away. And he was a nice guy. And I asked him, excuse me, what class is this? And he said it in his accent. He's like, oh, Sonny, this is International Finance 331. I go, oh, okay. So what class are you in? I go, well, this is Bacterial Physiology 446. He goes, oh, Sonny, don't even worry about any of this. You'll be in a lab. It was just like, oh, it felt like someone stabbed me because it was, I mean, he wasn't being mean. He was being facetious and funny. And I thought, yeah, he's making a joke about the major. But that's when I knew, like, this is not what I want to do. I'm not really into this at all, but this is what I got. So I got to finish the piece, get the piece of paper at least, and see what my options are.
And you finished, you got through in 4 years?
No, it took a while. So as I said, there was the aspect of kind of going back down to part-time for the funding aspect of it. So I finished by the time I was 20. Yeah. So I got...
Which is almost on par with a normal kid would do.
Yeah. I mean, they usually graduate like 22, I think. So yeah. It was a little early, but I was able to take some time to explore my interest. Again, at my parents' suggestion, the most useful class I ever took was Salsa 1 and Salsa 2. I know it's a class. It's actually a dance class. And my mom, I was getting burned out with organic chemistry and bacterial physiology, all these other things. And she said, I think you should take something a little more creative. And if you don't, we're not going to help you at all. Because my parents did help a little bit with the financial aspect of it. Before I took the loan. And I took it. And here's the best part. I don't really use my major all that much anymore. But I still dance. I still love dancing. So that was probably the most useful class I ever took. There you go.
And you, I mean, when you're expecting a child of 12, 13 to figure out what their major should be, that's a ridiculous request.
Yeah, they never were the type of parents to put that on me. I remember when I was 5, I was a very analytical kid. So I was 5 years old. I remember the first thing I wanted to be was an artist because I think it was the fact that I thought that was the quickest path to wealth. Because I remember it might have been some show my parents were watching and I heard someone appraising a painting at $1 million. I thought, that's the quickest way to earn money. I'm just going to do that. And again, my mom had art school background, so she was excited. And so she got me an art set and all these things. And I had the whole thing of like, oh, I'm going to draw, you know, make these artistic paintings. And they'd do the parental thing of putting on the fridge, whatever. And I remember by the time I got to first or second grade, you know, girls develop quicker with certain spatial recognition and patterns and drawing. And I would look at these other kids' drawings and I go, shit. I got to figure something else out. I'm not that good at art. And then probably by 7, I was thinking, well, you know, doctors are cool. I think that'll be a cool, and everyone respects a doctor. So surely that will be my path. And I like science. yeah, let's do that. And yeah, that held for a while. And then eventually your passions change and you realize that's not where you want it to go. But I still finished. I got the piece of paper, got the degree. Hard to find a job after that for the first year because it was still a recession.
And medical school was not in the cards?
No, it was the fact that most of my friends were older at that time.
Might have been hard to get into medical school at that age.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that too. You have no life experience.
That happened to my sister. My sister followed a path similar to yours, not as extreme, but she was a dentist and became unable to. She had been working in a motel for a couple of years because she was too young for any dental school to accept her.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, thank you for confirming that. You know,
probably would have happened to you too.
Would have been an uphill battle for sure, absolutely. And a lot of my friends that were older were telling me about the experiences of they went on to medical school and they were telling me what it was. And oh yeah, you know, it's kind of like when you talk to someone who had children but they didn't really want to have children, so they're saying it's great, like as if they're being stabbed to tell you. So I realized, well, okay, I've already gone through a lot of my teenage years for academia and pursuing something. I don't know if I want to sacrifice the 20s to do the same, and especially if it's not something I know I'm passionate about. So recognizing that, I decided to work for a while as like a lab tech and try that life. At the same time, still saying, well, I could always apply later, but just realizing it wasn't for me, that this is not the type of person for that. I don't really like hospitals. I'm not really into that environment. It just wasn't for me. So that's where we're at.
And then what did you do with your life at that point?
Well, at that point, I worked for a time in overnight shifts in labs, and I balanced that oddly enough with acting projects. So Arizona is more of a commercial acting market. But it was actually a friend of mine suggested getting into that when I was working that overnight shift, and they gave us control of the intercoms at work. And I was just bored at 2 a.m. No one cares. I would just do weird stuff in little accents like, oh, it's just Sheila's birthday in the break room, fucking cupcakes, you know, confuse people as to who worked there. And I had a friend just say, you know, maybe you should try acting roles. Like, it's not. No, I don't think so. But over time, I would do those projects and little castings for stuff, background roles and extra work and things along those lines. Never moved to L.A. like for that. That's a path well traveled, but it just wasn't. I still don't feel it's my path necessarily. But I would balance that and then whatever job I was working. So because of salsa dancing, I ended up meeting someone who became a referral into the financial world. So I worked in for financial firms doing what was called Vanguard. No, it's like, I don't mind saying it. But I handled like back end stuff for them. And it was like a whole different education. So I did actually end up Barry Siegel. I did end up learning about the world of all the things with stocks and bonds and all that. That was a second education, really, and I was grateful to have that background and get into that because it also educated me a lot about life and how life changes. So my first job doing anything financial related was handling death and divorce. So I would the best would be to talk to James Sexton because, you know, he has obviously a lot to say on that. But I've run into stories of, you know, how people split assets, how I've watched men's fortunes evaporate with the push of a finger because I had to do it, move your assets. So that was my job for a while in the financial sector and worked there for quite a while, got into project management. So you see your life changes. It keeps this flow. You can't really be committed to any one thing. If you have a passion or a vocation, yes, continue to do that. But that's where I've been and where you see me now. I'm kind of like on this Don Quixote arc. I don't know if you're familiar with
How old are you now?
I'm 34.
34.
Yeah.
And now more than ever, it's super important for a person to reinvent themselves regularly.
Yeah, I would say so, for sure. I think that's the
you can't just do it once or twice in your life. You're gonna need to do it every three, 4 years.
I would agree. Yeah, I think that's the beauty of the experience I had was it showed me that you don't have to go with convention. Like I said, I think I'm right. But I also think that if you understand that you have more capacity than you think, if you understand that you maybe, or especially a child, has more in them than what a school system says, because they all want to put you in a box. They put you, the school system in general just loves to put you in a box. And what I've learned is maybe a new appreciation for my country. Obviously, I have my own, you know, everyone has their own criticisms of the country they live in. But I will say this is the one place where you can do that, the easiest. You can do it wherever, but this is the place you could do it the easiest, the United States. If you say, you know what, I'm going to go for it and either start a business or start in another field or do something else. This is the country where it's the easiest. Where they actually, if you go to Europe, like Italy or Germany, you pick your school, your high school, you know, that's your path, right? So if you want to go to the art high school, the science high school, or the general education high school, all right, great. You finish that. Now you have a choice of the colleges. You get the engineering colleges, the arts colleges. So you're kind of on this path. Now, granted, you get like 8 weeks of vacation, so that's kind of nice. But you are being kind of pigeoned to what a system is telling you you have to do. Here, a little bit, but you have still that if you want it enough, you can change. You can put things, you know, I do acting. I'm an actor. It's the one job as a writer, anything creative, you say, I am this. Now, of course, it takes effort for you to put into that to make more of those things happen. But yes, it's the easiest here that you can do that.
Are you more fulfilled as an actor than you think you would be?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%. Because, I mean, there's passion there. There's more of something in the creative process.
Creativity adds so much richness to your life.
Absolutely, absolutely. So for me, yeah, I love acting. Have I thought about moving to Los Angeles? Yeah, I've thought about it. But the thing is, sometimes it's the times where we don't do things that are more important than when we do them. So for instance, the opportunity came up for me once to rent a room in LA at a friend. And he said, hey man, I got this room, came up, you know, would you like to move here? And I was thinking, there's something romantic about the idea of just cashing in your chips and saying, let's go. And I trust my intuition enough where I said, something doesn't feel quite there yet. I don't know what it is. And I feel I'm going to regret this maybe, but no, I'm not going to move there yet. And that was November 2019. So if I had done all these things, I would have been destroyed financially by cashing in the chips. Because what happened 3-4 months later, the entire city shut down. I had friends that moved here in February of 2020 not knowing, and then I'm giving them advice about, you know, coffee filters work as toilet paper if you think about it, because there was just nobody could really make anything happen. So I at this point, I just put my trust in God and in my intuition and seeing what happens. What happened to me recently was in 2024, I had a corporate layoff. I was a project manager for a bank. But it also coincided with my lease ending where I was renting in Phoenix. That doesn't really happen that often. And they paid me and I said, well, when, if not now, when? So that's when I've been since then, kind of, as I said, the Don Quixote arc, just kind of traipsing around. I do some freelance work and project management for some companies. But I've been doing more acting projects, and then I'll take a few months here and then I go off to South America and stay there for a while and just add to the richness of life experience.
I've known a handful of child prodigies like yourself, and they all, like unanimously, they all kind of just go off the rails sideways.
Okay, cool.
Nobody hasn't done that because it's like it's too much pressure to be such a high-performing student at 10, 12, 11, mm-hmm. 14, and then continue that for the rest of your life. It's like at some point you just go like what you probably did when you were 18 or 17. And mm-hmm. what am I doing? The girls are 5 years older than me or 4 years old, whatever they were. And everything is just like you're out of time.
Yes. Yes. I would 100% agree with that. And it's interesting. Again, I'm sure it would have been much worse for me had I not had the parents I did, because every step of the way, every change I've made, my parents we do what makes you happy.
And some of those decisions were some of the most extreme, ridiculous decisions that should be in that chair telling their story, but they just weren't quite ready for that yet. But they're insane. I know some insane stories. child prodigies.
I can see that. Well, I actually appreciate you telling me that because I don't really know anybody who had the trajectory I had. It's interesting when you meet people who had the conventional trajectory. So for me, I had, like I said, a lot of older friends I'd meet out, and they would tell me, "Oh, you're at ASU, you're in college. Oh, those are the best years of your life." And I was thinking, if these are the best years of my life, I'm going to jump off a bridge. I'm jumping off tomorrow. Fortunately, they were wrong. Life got much better after college, socially, economically, et cetera. But it's not, I would say, I wouldn't trade it for anything because it was so transformative. It was so different. But it's not for everybody. And there was that weird aspect of when I would meet people of my generation. So I'm, let's just say, 18, I'd meet the new incoming class at ASU. I'm already a senior by then. And I was doing college work when they were in their middle school diapers, right? And it felt like I was talking to people who were on a different planet. They had a completely different perception of reality. The way they spoke was different. The use of more filler words, I guess you could say. There was just a different energy. And then also the use of – there's something to be said for when you talk to people who are of a different generation or older, or even when I'd go on dates, the women that were a little older didn't use their cell phone all the time. They weren't addicted to social media. That really wasn't as much of a thing. So it's been a little harder, I think, as a guy, especially in this generation, that I didn't grow up with you, right? I grew up with other people. And also as an only child, my parents, you know, I was always with adults. So they'd have dinner parties, et cetera. You're always with adults. So I had a different type of influence. I was still a child, but I had my own development that went differently. So, but that emphasizes my point about the environment and the capacity with which what you have. 100 years ago, they could learn Greek. They knew their stuff. They had beautiful handwriting. Kids today don't even know cursive. So I guess I would say that there's definitely other options if you're ever considering your education of your own kids, anybody watching. Your kids are probably more capable than you're giving them credit for. Humans in general are more capable than we give them credit for.
But what I find fascinating is how some people, it's almost like we're hardwired. Our destiny is already set. Some of us peak out in high school.
Yes.
And others peak out in their 20s or 30s. I peaked out much, much, much later.
Did you though?
I think so. Yeah, I know so.
Really?
I did nothing in my, I mean, I did a lot. I was building and building and building through my teens and 20s and 30s and 40s, but I feel like I'm peaking right around now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the thing, because you have this empire. This is awesome.
I thought I peaked in my 40s, but this is even more fun than that.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is, I think that we just keep, I would hope that we keep developing, but you kind of have to be open to it. Like you said, reinventing yourself every few years is important.
It's the most exciting and fun thing a person can do.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So
I remember I had given up my advertising career, and that's all I ever did since I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I was already doing advertising in high school. And I'm like, so I'm going to quit this. And I was just like, now I'm just a human. I'm not even a photographer anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm just a human. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what I am. And I took like a year or two off and just kind of went to the gym a lot and got in great shape, but I wasn't going to become a gym rat. So I eventually started this, and this has been the most exciting ride I've been on.
I could see that.
Really fun.
Well, and you get to observe so much of the human condition. That's so cool. That's very fascinating.
Yeah, I'm seeing it right here, 10 feet away.
Here's a slice, right? But you have many different slices, but.
Yeah, I love the variety now.
Yeah.
Like I used to, when I started this project, it was like a bunch of drug addicts on Skid Row, mm-hmm. but now it's so much more diversified.
I like it too. I mean, to me, there's a certain poetry of life. So as I'm kind of on this weird, like pulling the thread of destiny type thing, following either spiritual cryptic dreams or signs. I'm into it. I think that it's exciting. It led me here, right? I did not imagine when I first started watching Softwood Underbelly in, I think it was 2020.
Oh, wow.
That I would be here to do it. But something inside me said, you know what? I think my story is kind of interesting.
Your story is very interesting.
I'm going to try and see how it goes.
I think if you stay positive, which you seem very positive.
Thanks.
As am I. Then anything is possible.
Yeah.
Literally anything is possible. But if you get negative and say, well, I'm too old to do that and I'm just too poor to do this or too whatever, then you're going to stay exactly where you are. But if you think anything is possible, then anything is possible.
I 100% agree. I think that life is this tapestry, this cosmic tapestry of events that if you're willing to traverse it, pull at the threads of it, be open-minded to different shifts and changes.
Be courageous.
Put yourself out. Put yourself in circulation. You really never know what will come your way. And if it didn't happen as a child, it doesn't mean it has to happen. You don't have to have like the background of like, oh, I was super educated as a child. No, you could start anytime and things will happen. You put your, I think I was literally talking to my mom the other day about even me being here. And it's like I said, you know, I'm just putting my rock in the middle of the pond and sending out ripples and see what happens, see what comes my way from that. But every action we do is like that rock in the pond and putting out ripples into the universe. So there's that.
Yeah. It's really fascinating to me in life how every action always has these reactions that you can't take back and you can't undo. And they're just things that seal your future and fate. And it's like, it's just this ongoing process of, okay, I'm going to move to this city and I'm not going to marry that person. And I'm going to do this. I'm not going to do that. And all these decisions create this life that sometimes these decisions are, you can't take them back. You can't undo them. You can't say, oh, you know what? That was a mistake. Let me go back and marry that girl that now is married with three kids. And that city no longer has the industry that I used to think it did. And so many things change. And it's just, to me, that whole ride is fascinating and fun and scary.
It is. And it's, it requires a certain sense of vulnerability for sure. But it's amazing.
A willingness to fail.
Oh yeah.
Is super important.
I think that's where what my experience helped me with was learning a bit more humility, because I wasn't the best student. I wasn't. I mean, I was good. I had okay.
You're in college at 13.
Yeah, but I mean, I wasn't getting straight A's, right? And so when you fall, the first microbiology class, my major class, I failed. I was devastated. I was sick. Now, granted, it was with a instructor who was notorious for having a 50% fail rate, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all use Rate My Professor. That was the big website back then. And this university I was at was a research-based university. So basically, they hired the professors based off their research and the grants that they could get from them. It wasn't because they were great teachers. But either way, I failed. And that was humbling, kicking the balls. I'm 16. I'm thinking, is my life over, right? But no, I got up, retook the class. It's like a redo. That happened twice. I failed calculus as well. And so I said, well, fuck, all right, I'm going to try again. And each time builds a degree of resilience. So whether it's a course or a dating relationship or a financial maneuver, these things happen. I guess, I was anticipating this question, but I'm going to say it anyway, which is, would I recommend college for, if I was 18 years old, would I go to college now? Fuck no. We can swear on this, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Fuck no. Not at all. I would not go. I think it was perfect for me, for what I did and kind of where I'm going, because it added to my life experience. It peppered it. But if I was 18 years old right now, unless you want to be a lawyer, a doctor, something like an engineer that requires that, something STEM, nurse, right? Don't go. It is – so I was in the School of Life Sciences. I went in 2008, 2007. It was pretty objective, what's the scientific process. But I think that colleges in general are now a structured, obviously, thing for profit. The price is not worth it. The juice is not worth the squeeze. I thought taking a loan for $12K was, but that's not that much compared to these people, especially UCLA, wherever, getting hundreds of thousands in debt for a major that might not be market equivalent in jobs. If I could give any advice to the young male out there wanting to be, you know, 18 to 20, it would likely be take it for a grain of salt. You know, it's like maybe your slightly older brother talking. I don't know, but
male or female,
male or female, correct. I would say learn a skill. Maybe learning, if you don't want to do the trades, which is a very honorable, good pathway, you start a business very easily. And also, you don't need to go to business school to run a business. You could start an LLC for $80, but okay. But everything's free online for the most part. But I would say learn a skill, whether it's manual, or learn how to be an AI implementation person. So not the coder, but someone who knows how it works. Learn a foreign language. Top two choices, Spanish or Mandarin. Go to the gym, and then also invest in a creative passion. Photography, art, dancing, acting, whatever. You don't know where that's going to take you. If you do those five things, you're pretty well set in your youth, and you can build off of that. That's what I would do if I was 18. Now, I wouldn't recommend college.
Except college, I mean, my oldest daughter just graduated from Oregon.
Okay.
Up in Eugene, Oregon. And she really didn't want to finish her last year.
Mm.
Took a year off, and then finally her mom and I talked her into finishing, and she did. And it wasn't even like, oh, you're going to get a better job if you do this, because chances are technology, AI will advance mm-hmm. so much that your job market's going to change so drastically. But it builds self-esteem. It builds that, you know what, I'm a college graduate.
Yeah.
And that there's something to be said for that.
There is, especially since we already started the process, yes. But, I mean, if you haven't started that process and it's not something if you're doing it just to do it, or someone expects you to do it, if you want to do it, just go for it. If that's what you really want to do, of course. But a lot of people go because maybe their parents, my parents never pushed me to go. I was the one that was like, you know what? I'm going to try this. But don't go because it's a societal expectation. Establish a base for yourself. Definitely go through some sort of course curriculum, whether it's something you love or something you feel will be valuable to get that self-esteem, yes. But don't go because it's an expectation of someone else. So that's what I would say in terms of any advice I had for anybody who's younger.
Be adventurous. Listen to yourself. And just be ready to adapt.
Yeah, and pull on those threads of destiny. You never know where they are.
Mm-hmm. Move to India.
Okay, well, if that's where you're calling, that's not my thread of destiny, but if someone's thread of destiny.
Do you have regrets in your life, Will?
Do I have regrets? No, I don't have a substantial regret. And I don't know if that's, I mean, I think that's a good thing. I wouldn't say, there are things I would say I wish I could go back and do differently. There are things I would say, I would probably handle that differently. But because I have that now, because I know that now, well, that made me a better person because I can deploy that later, right? I don't know if it was Albert Camus that said, to live is to have scars. That might not be Camus, but either way, it's true. You're going to get beat up a little bit. You're going to have some tragic things. I mean, I'm grateful. So as I said, my father passed away. He was an amazing man. I had him for 31 fantastic years. And I think I learned, when you lose somebody, the value of a lot of things, right? So for a while in my late 20s, I was like, well, maybe I just need to try to make money, and that's the thing. And I still made time, of course, for my parents, but that was a fixation. But then after losing something so close, if you were to tell me, hey, Will, I can give you 10 minutes with your dad again, I would give you every dollar I had plus 5 years in the future, Zamani. Like, you want that in a check? Because that is so not relevant to having something such a pillar of my life to have that. So you learn, and unfortunately, I didn't put money ahead of my parents. I'm just giving like an example of relative value. Like, I always knew the relationship I had with my family was way more important than money or pursuing money. But you truly learn the value or the absurdity of certain things that we chase in life when you've experienced loss, 100%. Mm. So I wouldn't say I have any regrets. There are things I guess I could do differently. but there's nothing that I'm thinking, wow, that was a profound thing that I messed up, because, and maybe I do, but the way I look at it is I learned from that. Right. So I'm hopefully young enough still that if anything, like let's say for a romantic relationship on the same caliber of maybe one that I felt, oh, I could have handled that even better. If that comes around again, well, I'm much more prepared for that. And also the scars that we have are incredibly healing to other people. So I lost a parent. Right. The first people I called were my friends who lost parents. And I can now be someone that when my friends lose their parents, I can at least know what a pain feels like that they've experienced. If I have a wife and she has both parents at this point of my life or her point of her life, I'll be there to be able to empathize what the loss of a parent is like, understanding that. So yeah, that's, I don't know if I answered your question the best way possible. You,
to back it up a few minutes where we're just talking about life and all the ups and downs that we have to deal with. There's a great, my friend Ashley Hamilton, who I interviewed just this weekend, he was texting me yesterday, and he left a quote from his father, George Hamilton, the actor, whose dad said, there are two kinds of people in this world, people who have had their asses handed to them and those who are about to have their asses handed to them.
That's very true.
I just thought that was a great quote.
That's very true, yeah.
Because if you haven't had your ass handed to you, you haven't lived.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And that comes on different levels. It could be a physical ass handing, or
it could be somebody mental. Biker breaking your nose.
Yeah.
Or it could be just getting laid off because your industry has imploded.
Yeah. And what you're going to do from there.
Or getting divorced when you don't see it happening. Or it could be a million things. Auto accidents. Anything.
Yes. And so that's why I try to be as grateful every day that, hey, I can walk. I can see. I can meet Mark later.
Having gratitude is a great, great thing to have.
Absolutely, because there's always something that we can be grateful for.
Have you been in love?
Oh, yeah, I have been in love, actually. I have. Do you want like the details?
Sure. What the fuck?
I've been in love, and I'm very grateful that I have been. One of the key relationships.
It would be so sad. I'm listening to your story and hearing how unusual your childhood was, and you couldn't really meet anybody in high school, mm-hmm. and probably after that it was kind of awkward. And I wonder if this guy has ever been in love. If you haven't, that would be such a sad story.
Yeah, no, it would be, right? Yeah.
even though love ends tragically, usually.
Well, it was David Foster Wallace. I love books, in case you can't tell. So I'm just referencing all the... David Foster Wallace said every love story is a ghost story. Mm. Right? And I think James Sexton said every relationship ends. It's either you part ways or one of you dies.
Right.
But for me, in terms of love life, yeah, there was a date. Well, first off, there was dating, which isn't... I did actually, at the last year, the 11th hour, I did have a girlfriend at ASU.
And you did?
Yes, and my friends teased me. And they're like, wow, congratulations.
Was she older than you?
2 or 3 years older than me, yeah. But my friends teased me saying, wow, Will, great job. Didn't graduate a virgin at ASU. Big achievement. But it was a good relationship. It was more than just that. But in terms of deep love, one of the deep loves I had was with a woman 20 years older than me, oddly enough. Yeah. Yeah.
Good for you.
She was a Colombian. She is still alive. She's still alive. She's despite being 20 years older, still alive. Amazing woman. She was a telenovela actress from Colombia. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you think, oh, well, you know, I don't know, maybe this will just be fun because there's this age gap difference. And then life's not a porn. You can have emotions with people, especially physical connections. So yeah, we ended up dating for the better part of 3 years. It was a phenomenal relationship. You feel, I mean, that introduced me to the Latin variety of love and feeling appreciated and warm and the feminine energy that they bring. And since then, I mean, maybe I've been trying to replicate that to a degree with nominal success. There's a reason why I like going to South America. there's a certain type of energy, a certain flow, a certain passion that they have. But I'm not like a sex tourist. I'm looking for actual meaning. There's something to be said for meaning and poetry and what we look for. So I have been living life through this kind of poetic lens, and I've made a few trips in the past couple years there, and I've felt similar emotions in the journeys I've gone.
You're trying to recreate something, but there's nothing wrong with that.
I feel like, yes, you're right. I'm trying to
guarantee you a Scandinavian girl or an Asian girl or a whatever girl could be just as fascinating and fun.
This is true. Accent's different, but this is true. I get what you're saying, and I don't dispute that. I guess I also like the cultural differences, and would there be a possibility of building a life in that location in the future? I'm something I'm exploring or being open to, but yeah, that I would say there have been a few moments, well, more than a few moments, but substantial moments where I have been in love on a very deep level, like a spiritual level.
That's great. And if you know what your type is, that just kind of takes you somewhere where the things might happen.
Yeah. And I've still maintained friendly relationships with that woman. And so I've even told, she knows that I've gone to South America. I go, look, there's only one of you. Can I just get in the ballpark? That's fine. That's all I need. So that's what I've tried to do. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Good luck. Let me ask you one last question, Will. What would you say is the most important thing you've learned in your life?
Wow. Time is limited. Appreciate your parents. They're not around forever. Remember that every time, and it doesn't have to just be with relationships that are older than you. I think we're not a very death conscious people. Even as Americans, I would say one of the critiques is we're not a death culture. So how do we treat a lot of our elderly? We kind of warehouse them. We kind of don't want to see. I'm against that. I'll put them over here, and you know they're fine. And it's like we don't have this appreciation for death. And I think if we did. If we treated death as a friend that's on its way to visit us, imagine the Grim Reaper's crossing a field. It's a long, wide field, and you are over here, but eventually it's going to come to you. Give it some good stories when it arrives. Treat it like it's a friend that's going to be catching up with you when it comes. Make it smile, because the quote is, when death smiles at us, all we can do is smile back. But if you treat death like a friend and know that it's always there, I think you'll appreciate life more. Death's not supposed to be something that is the absolute end. And also, you've already been dead, right? It was the occasion that you were before you were born. Now, I believe in an afterlife, but even if you don't, you already were there. You experienced what existed. So you get this beautiful time period, this beautiful journey, however long it lasts, for however long it can be. To get some really great experiences and experience some very deep, beautiful things, so that by the time your old friend visits you, you get to tell him a lot. So yeah, treat death as a friend.
That's wonderful. What a fascinating talk.
I really enjoyed it, Mark.
Yeah, I did too. It was really fun. Will, thank you so much, and maybe we'll check in again in a couple of years and see where you're at.
Thank you.
That was really great. Thank you.